everyone. Thank you so much for taking the time to participate. This is the Conference for Women's first of what will be a monthly series of online events, and we're really excited about these and hope you'll continue to join us. Thank you for taking the time tonight. Our discussion this evening is with best-selling author and expert negotiator Victoria Pinchon, and I think it says a lot about the need for this kind of expertise that we have so many dynamic women dialed in for tonight's book club. Now, before I introduce our speaker, let's open the lines for a minute and say hello. Can we make a little noise to give Vicky a warm Conference for Women welcome? Victoria is an expert on conflict resolution and specifically on closing the wage and income gap for women, which is something we were all interested in hearing about. She's been featured on NPR's All Things Considered, the New York Times, CNN, Wall Street Journal, and many other news outlets. What we're going to do tonight is she's going to give us an overview of her book for about 20 minutes, and then we'll have time for a brief Q&A at the end. And thank you to those who sent your questions in advance. I really appreciate that. So without further ado, and we are going to try to stick to our schedule tonight, I'm pleased to introduce Vicky Pinchon, who will be discussing her book, The Grown-Ups ABCs of Conflict Resolution.
Welcome, Vicky. Thank you. Thank you so much, and thank you for opening the lines to give me a little feedback. I really want to connect with people, and I particularly want to connect with women about conflict resolution, about negotiation, and about two or three takeaways that I want to give everyone tonight that I believe you'll be able to use tomorrow. And if you're not able to use them tomorrow, and you want further reading or further advice on this, I can direct you to some good resources, and I'll do that toward the end. The book, The Grown-Ups ABCs of Conflict Resolution, really covers just about everything I learned when I went back to school to study conflict resolution. And during that period of time, I also came back to women and women's issues. And I did that because I was blogging, and women started calling me and saying, we'd like you to come and teach us how to negotiate. And almost all of my knowledge about women negotiating comes both from reading, but more particularly from actually working with women, from being a consultant, from being a trainer, and finding out what are the barriers to our asking. So I'm going to read a little bit of W is for Women. I'm going to take the story out of it. Each letter of the ABCs stands for a different person. Each person has some type of conflict to resolve, and each chapter talks about the social psychology of conflict or the negotiation or conflict resolution way to look at it. So I'm going to launch into the wage gap, then I'm going to give you some tools to take home tonight. And this about the wage gap is from about the middle of the chapter of W is for Women. So a significant part of the explanation for the persistence of this terrible 33% wage and income gap between men and women is our failure to negotiate. And here are some of the statistics. I'm just going to touch on a few of them. By failing to routinely negotiate our salaries, we lose up to $1 million over the course of our careers, exacerbated by the fact that this affects our retirement income. Although women own 40% of all businesses in the United States, we receive only 2.3% of the available equity capital needed for growth. And that makes women-owned businesses much more vulnerable to failure, and our employees more vulnerable to wage loss. And though satisfied with our work performance, even when we feel like we're doing a really great job, we expect to be paid far less than men in identical jobs. 4% less when we begin our career, and 23% less when we're at our career peak. Now, here's actually my favorite study. Women and men were asked to come into a room and count count the dots on a square until they felt they were entitled to earn the $4 they were being paid to participate in this experiment. So they're just given a bunch of cards. They had dots on them. They had to count those dots until they felt like, okay, I deserve that $4. Here's the killer. Women worked 22% longer and 10% faster than the men before they thought they were entitled to the same amount of money. So I want you to pay particular attention to that last study. Despite the revolution in our work and our career choices over the last 30 years, and despite the number of us who become lawyers and doctors and engineers and mathematicians, this 33% wage gap continues to persist. So what if a significant portion of that wage gap could be attributed to our failure to ask? We work 22% longer and 10% faster. That's 32%. That is practically the entire wage gap. Now, my business partner and I at She Negotiate, we both believe that each individual woman can close that wage gap tomorrow by learning how to negotiate. There are obstacles that face us. There is gender blowback. But here's the really great news. We are negotiating every day, and we already know how to do it in the way that the best business schools in the country are teaching both men and women to negotiate, and that is interest-based negotiation. So what's interest-based negotiation? I'm sure you've heard about it. A lot of you have probably read Getting to Yes, which is 30 years ago now, and something I never read, even though it was on my bookshelf for 20 years, because I was negotiation averse. I did not want to negotiate. I thought I wouldn't be a good negotiator, and recent research has shown that most of us feel this way. So what we've done is to reframe. I'm going to talk about framing and anchoring tonight. We reframed negotiation, and we don't tend to use the word negotiation, nor do we even talk about the word ask. We define negotiation as a conversation that leads to agreement. And women love conversation, and women definitely love agreement. The best way to have this conversation leading to agreement is to find out what our negotiation partner's interests are, which is why this is called interest-based or mutual benefit negotiation. So we want to find out who they are, what they want, what they desire, what preferences they have, what their priorities are, who is better at eliciting that information than we are. I have some grown stepchildren. We're hoping for grandbabies. Every time my husband talks to his ex-wife, I know that she talks to the kids a little bit more intimately than he does. So I say, you know, did you ask Helen about Adam and Lori? Are they talking about having kids yet? And he says, nope, didn't ask her. And then he'll tell me something like, but Adam said, his son Adam said, that, you know, they're thinking about it. And I said, well, what, you know, did you ask her a follow-up question? And he said, nope. So, really, we would ask the follow-up questions. I would ask the follow-up questions, and so would you. So negotiation, this old idea of negotiation as being an attempt to change somebody else's mind is really a very old model. It's what I did for 25 years as an attorney, try and change people's minds. And I can tell you that looking back on a 25-year career, I would flip a coin. I couldn't predict every win and every loss, but I certainly lost cases I thought I should win. I won cases I thought I should lose. And as much power as the power of the law gives you, you still find that you are working against forces that are really incomprehensible to you because you don't know what the jury is thinking and you don't know what the judge is thinking. You don't know what interests them, what they need, what they desire. So negotiation, fortunately, allows us to have these comfortable, rambling conversations that women love to have about what do you do and what are you interested in and what do you want and how's business, which is one of my favorite opening questions, by the way, to get an idea about who the person I'm talking to, what he or she could possibly want and what I might be able to do for them. So when I'm networking, which is also a negotiation, a conversation you hope will lead to the agreement where someone hires me, I ask that question a lot, how's business? And I get answers like, bad, business is not great, the economy seems to be improving, the ice is breaking. And then I ask a little bit further, like, what do you find your greatest challenges are now? And I do a little problem solving, and eventually they say, what do you do for a living? And I say, well, you know, I help people solve problems. I'm a mediator, and I'm a negotiation consultant and trainer. And they've become interested. I don't have to sell myself. So this soft sell, by the way, is something that I never thought I could have my own business. So the soft sell, all of the tools that I learned in negotiation school about learning about people's preferences and priorities has really served me in the building of my business as well. So let me give you these three takeaways. The first takeaway is asking diagnostic questions of your negotiation partner. The researchers say that 93% of all negotiators fail to ask these diagnostic questions when to do so would significantly improve the outcome of their hypothetical negotiation, 93%. So there are only 7% of all negotiators ask these questions of their bargaining partners, which means if you start asking these questions in the workplace, in your community, wherever it is you are attempting to have influence, you will be doing better than 93% of all of the business people in the country. So here's the what my partner calls the crown jewel of interest-based negotiation, that's asking diagnostic questions. The purpose of these questions is to ascertain, what does my bargaining partner want? Everyone thinks that everybody else wants money, which I believe is the biggest mass illusion in modern life, because none of us really want money. We want whatever it is that money can buy. We want to save for retirement. We want to send our kids to college. We want to pay off mom's mortgage. We want to make sure we don't end up in a state-owned nursing home when we're 90. So, and sometimes delivering the thing somebody wants directly to them instead of using this intermediary of money, we can accomplish the goal of our bargaining partner and our own goal much more quickly. Let me give you an example that is directly within the women's conferences. When the women's conferences asked me if I wanted to speak, I said yes, we talked terms, right? And there's a question I'm going to answer at the end about how do you ask for a particular sum of money? And we had a conversation leading to agreement, and part of what I took as my compensation for speaking was this, because this is an opportunity for me to spread the word, which is part of my mission, and it's also an opportunity for me to promote myself. So let's say the women's conferences were going to pay, part of my fee would be $500. If I got that money, I would put it into marketing my business. So the women's conferences provided me directly with a marketing services for my business. I don't have to pay Uncle Sam tax on that. And I get directly something that's relatively easy for them to do for me. It's relatively low cost for them, but it's a very high benefit for me. That's called log rolling. And the only way you can learn whether or not you have these items of differing values to trade, when you go beyond money, is to ask these diagnostic questions. What is it that you're really interested in? If I paid you $5,000, what would you do with that money? What are your preferences? What is your view about the future? What are you afraid of? What are the things that you fear? What are you saving for? These are ways that you can have a conversation where you can begin to get a bead on the value that each party actually has to trade with the other one. They're open-ended. Who, what, when, why, where, and how. And they're conversational. They're not, we're not this negotiation idea of, you know, I'll pay you $10 for the sunglasses. No, I need $25. Well, I'll pay you $12.50. That's haggling. That's bargaining. But it's not negotiation. Negotiation is this open-ended conversation. It's, you always have the opportunity to pull back in and say, I hear that that number is very high for you. Why don't you tell me about it? Why don't you tell me why that number is too high? And I do this all the time because women's organizations ask me to speak for them, and I have to tell them what my fee is, and I don't want to be so high that they're going to just, you know, put down the phone and say, oh, I can't afford her. So what I do is to try and help the women's organizations figure out a way that they can afford me. So this negotiated conversation leading to an agreement is, it's really just a problem-solving session. So that's the one of the important things I want you to take away tonight. The next important thing is anchoring. This is the reason I decided to go back to school. When I was a very young lawyer, I was taught never make the first offer. And the first morning of my first negotiation class, I learned that the person who makes the first offer anchors the bargaining range in their favor and influences the outcome till the very last concession is made. So you have to, if you want to maximize your return, and this is hard for women to do, you need to anchor first and you need to anchor high. And the reason you need to anchor high is partially because it will influence your bargaining partner in your direction, but also because you need to make concessions. You need to be in a, because your bargaining partner is going to bargain with you. If they accept your offer immediately, you're going to feel bad because you're going to think you left something on the table. So you need to, what I tell people is you need to start 3 to 5 moves in advance, because people are most satisfied with the outcome of a negotiation, not by the raw number they achieve, but by the number of concessions their bargaining partner makes. So recently I helped a woman negotiate the resolution of an employment dispute. She at first said she didn't want any money. She just wanted to walk away with her work product. And I counseled her that I thought that she could be out of work for a long time. We're still in this recession, and she's 3 months pregnant. So we agreed on a number. She didn't want to start high. We asked for 50. They gave her 50. And, of course, I had a little bargainer's remorse because I thought, well, if they would pay 50, they would have paid 75. Maybe they would have paid 100. But some women are just not comfortable asking for a lot to begin with. So that's anchoring. Anchor high. Anchor first. Give yourself room to negotiate. Be prepared to make your concessions. And when you make those concessions, ask for reciprocity. People will more or less naturally reciprocate, but naming your concessions, saying that they're hard to make, and asking or telling your bargaining partner that you expect them to be reciprocated will really kick that in so that you get kind of laser-like in your negotiation. The last, the third takeaway I want you to take away tonight is framing, which is kind of like anchoring, but it's more like political spinning. So what's framing? Framing is defining the terms of the thing that you're selling or the thing that you're buying or the person who you're selling you to an employer or to a client. The frame focuses your bargaining partner's attention on what's inside the frame. Just picture a frame in your mind, and it excludes anything that's outside of it. So, for instance, if a photographer snaps a shot of all the medium height students in the fifth grade, you're unlikely to focus on their height or their shortness. But if he includes the shortest or the tallest, you're going to start thinking about height. If he puts one African-American student in with a bunch of Asian students, you're going to start thinking about race. So you want to frame your offer or the purpose of the negotiation in such a way that that you've set the table, that you've set the terms, that you define what the parties should be saying and how they should be doing it. As a mediator, I can tell you quickly that I tend to reframe or help people reframe their disputes from fighting to problem solving, from being right to being happy, from being competitive to being cooperative, from fighting over an unproductive past to a productive future, and from a potential loss to a potential gain. And all of that information is contained both in the ABCs of Conflict Resolution. It's also contained in my book called Success as a Mediator for Dummies, and I try to talk the Wiley people into broadening the frame of that book and not having it be kind of book for people who want to be mediators, but a more general book about conflict resolution. And they said, no, we've already decided we wanted it to be this way. But that book is filled with negotiation advice. And both of them are pretty cheap if you've got a Kindle.
Thank you, Vicki. Can I jump in?
Yes, please do.
Thank you so much for that. Again, if you've just joined us, this is Amy Cooper, and we're with the Conference for Women. Victoria Pinchon is speaking on the Grown-Ups ABCs of Conflict Resolution. So now we're going to take some time for some Q&A, and Vicki has agreed to give us a few more minutes of her time, and I don't want this to run late. So the first question comes from Amy, who works in marketing in a small office environment and would like some advice about a difficult and very inefficient office environment. We've all been there when any time a decision is made, multiple people need to be told about it, have to give their opinions, and it gets messy. Vicki, how would you suggest navigating around the different management styles that the work that Amy and her coworkers need to do is done with greater efficiency?
This is a great question, by the way. First, I would recommend meeting in a casual place with food, because food stimulates the trust-enhancing hormone and the bonding hormone, oxytocin. So even if you're meeting in someone's office, bring in scones or croissants. Have something to eat. Start with small talk, in which affiliation begins. And then this problem is the perfect problem for the use of diagnostic questions. So I would take the lead if I were in this situation, and I would start with a few very open-ended questions, like, if the process of greenlighting projects could be exactly the way you, let's say, Don, want it to be, what would that look like to you? And if Don says it would look like A, B, and C, then say, well, do you think that there's something that stands in the way of doing it? And if there are differing opinions, you can, again, you're just problem solving. Can you imagine satisfying Don's desire to have what he wants? He wants the director's cut, essentially, on the project. And also satisfying your desire to have the last word, and then go, just keep going deeper. So you want to have the last word on this. Why is that? Right? What is it about? What are you worried about? And then when you find out what he's worried about, you're going to have a whole new set of questions to ask, and everyone's going to be surprised, I guarantee you, what everybody else is thinking and what they're concerned about. You're going to deepen the relationship, and you're going to solve the problem. Sounds like it's hard to solve if you're trying to guess why people are doing what they're doing. So perfect for for the use of these diagnostic questions.
Thank you. That was very helpful. Our second question is from Sue, and she's asking, how do you handle negotiations in a situation where you're offered a job that you're very interested in, but the salary is lower than what you want and need, and you know the company can't afford much more than that?
Another great question. I get this all the time, and I can tell you that when I consult with women, they usually get somewhere between 20 and 40% more than they think than they first think they can. So I'm not certain how anyone actually knows that a company can't pay you what you need to be paid. So here are some just stock phrases that you can use after you've given your number and the person's jaw drops open, okay? Or you hear them go silent on the phone. I say, listen, there are a million working parts to this deal. I would love to work here. And if you feel the same way, let's talk about the ways that we can satisfy your budgetary restraints and my compensation requirements at the same time. And remember that the budget did not come down on stone tablets from Mount Sinai. Somebody made the budget. Who made the budget? This budget may not be sufficient to get the job done that the company needs to hire someone who's as good as you in order to do it. If you feel really reluctant to put a big number on the table, you have to understand that that first salary, that first number that you're paid as a new employee is going to anchor you in that job for as many years as you stay there. So the way to break out of that is to say, you know, today I'm willing to work for X. I think that in 6 months you're going to find that I have added enough value that we'll be talking about the salary that is really my salary requirement, so which is Y. So you put that number on the table. Remember, that's an anchor. It's going to draw your negotiation partner in their direction. And set a date certain. Say, let's talk in 6 months. Would you be willing to do that, to revisit this issue? And people, if they want you, they will rarely say, no, I won't revisit it in 6 months. And then be a star for 6 months.
And to lead off of that, because you talked about anchoring in the beginning when you were talking about your takeaways, so if you agree to come back in 6 months, are you at a disadvantage at that point because you've already, you know, given yourself away a little bit?
Yes. I would start with what my actual requirement is. I would start by saying this is market, and I would do your market research on Glassdoor.com, and I would say this is what the market is paying for this position, and I'm right in market, and so I want to be paid X. That revisit in 6 months is if your negotiation partner is absolutely opposed to listen to anything other than what they've been authorized to pay you for the job. And only at that point would I say, you know, I can see that you're tied up by the budget. I'd love to know what went into budgeting that number for this position, since it's not within market, but, you know, I'd be willing to talk about this again in 6 months or 3 months or 2 weeks. Let's go back to the drawing board and come in with solutions to the problems that you think that they're trying to solve by hiring you. So again, it's a conversation, and even though you want to know that you're doing things like anchoring and you're framing everything favorably to yourself, you're also really just having this conversation like, what are your problems? You know, who is the person who's doing the hiring? They might be incredibly frustrated that they haven't been given enough money to hire the best person. I know that when I was practicing, there were times when I was not given enough money to hire the associates who I needed to do the job. So if you learn that, you might be able to help the person who's doing the hiring find a way to look at another budget line item and pay you more. I do that all the time because women's initiatives are not adequately funded. And I'm told, well, it's all we have. You know, we can only pay you $150 to come speak to us for an hour. And I think, really? You're a Am Law 10 law firm? And you spend more than that on lunch. Is there another line item in the budget? And there always is. There's continuing education. There's the library fund. There's be a problem solver. Help them pay you what you deserve to be paid.
Well, thank you. We have time, I think, for one more question. It is already 8:30. The last question I'm going to read to you is from MB, and she's asking, as a professional with a long background in HR, how do you market yourself when you want to take your career in a different direction?
So I have to tell you, this will age me, but I always think in response to this question, that old song about wear your hair just for him, do the things he likes to do. So what I would say is, know who your market is, read what they read, write for the journals that they read, join their groups, listen to their concerns, speak at their events, blog, use social media. I hired a marketing consultant when I started my own business, and she asked me one really good question. She said, what does your market need to know in order to hire you? And I said, that's easy. They need to know I'm a member of their club. I need to dress like them. I need to kind of look like them. I need to be someone who's not at all threatening, who seems to be like right inside what their business is. And that's exactly what I've done my entire, you know, this kind of third act of my own life in moving from a legal practice to a mediation and a consulting business.
Thank you. To everyone who's participated, thank you all for your time tonight. I hope you'll continue to join us on these monthly events. And to Vicki, a big shout out and thank you so much for your time and expertise and taking the time to share this with us tonight. I think it was really helpful and very appreciated.
Thank
so,
you.
From
and
the
follow the blog at Forbes. She negotiates. There's
did you hear
a
that?
Lot more of this.
Her Forbes blog at She Negotiates. And the conference for women will be signing off. Thank you again.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Good night.
Good night.